Good afternoon and welcome to another Burr News Facebook Live. I'm Don Burgess, and today I have the pleasure and privilege of sitting with Dr. Kewan Brown of North Shore Medical Center. Welcome, Dr. Brown.
Thank you for having me.
Today we're going to be talking about the medical marijuana, medicinal cannabis, and it's sort of a good jumping off point because CBS yesterday rejected an ad for the Super Bowl for medical marijuana, and sort of like been a social media storm that they rejected it. Why do you think people have this negative perception about medicinal purposes for cannabis and marijuana?
Well, I think it's because they just don't know. And they don't know its history, they don't know how long it's been around, and because most people now are relatively young. This has been around since the year 2736 BC. So clearly no one's living that long. But it's really just education, lack of education, lack of understanding.
Right. Well, I know like a lot of people are seeing the United States and Canada sort of embracing this movement, but even prior to here, it was legal in the United States?
Most definitely. I think it came off of the U.S. Pharmacopoeia in 19, I just referring to my notes, in 1942. Mm-hmm. So it's been an available medication up to the year 1942.
So, like in the United States, why do you think there was the resistance and they pulled it off the books?
Well, they actually lobbied a tax on medicinal marijuana. It was a $1 tax, and that was the start of it. And then Bush Sr. Found that it wasn't in their interest to keep this going. There was a gentleman that got a prescription for it in the 1940s in reference to glaucoma, and then 33 other patients also was able to get handheld or hand-rolled marijuana cigarettes from the U.S. government, and he felt that was a program that he wasn't willing to continue to support. At the time, the head of the Food and Drug Administration stated that it is something that should still be available, and he is quoted in saying that it's safer than eating 8 potatoes.
So your efforts in Bermuda, when did you start this and why did you start it?
We started it probably about 3 or 4 years ago. And the reason why is because we have a number of patients. Well, first of all, let's go back. So I think Sanjay Gupta was really what opened up my eyes to the possibility of medicinal cannabis or marijuana for medical treatments. And, you know, when I saw someone who I have high respect for as a physician, and it was on CNN, this whole documentary, I was like, okay, this is something that we need to further explore. And I think during that time, we also had some patients that I have tried everything that I can possibly do as a clinician. We've sent them overseas to the Johns Hopkins, to the Leahy's, etc. And they waved the proverbial white flag, i.e. they can't do anything more for the patient. So we said, you know, what do we do? And this was at the time of the Sanjay Gupta's interview and documentary on medicinal cannabis for seizures. And I said, in this case, the patient was having seizures. So I said, this may be a possibility that we need to explore.
So besides seizures, what else is CBD or marijuana used to help treat, or where they think it might help treat?
Well, a number of things. And I was just at a conference this weekend, the Orlando Dermatology Conference. There was about 5,000 doctors. It was huge. And we actually had a symposium on medicinal cannabis as it relates to dermatology, because what they're finding in that is that for inflammatory disease such as eczema, psoriasis, melanomas, that in animal models and in vitro models, it's showing to be very efficacious. So some of the other, and that's new, but some of the wide known and acceptable uses for medicinal cannabis is for pain, for glaucoma, as we talked about previously, for intractable seizures, that's the Charlotte's Web variant, fibromyalgia, and the list goes on and on. There's actually over 1,000 published papers on the PubMed internet site, which is our medical reference go-to for any sort of clinical research or evolving clinical research. So it's been going on for quite some time, and even though there isn't a lot of human studies, the research is still there in vitro. And the reason why there's not any human studies is because Big Pharma, unfortunately, is not going to give the money for research. And two, because it's a Schedule I drug, that means a Schedule I means that it has no therapeutic benefit whatsoever, None whatsoever. That's what the Schedule 1 means. And just for comparison, cocaine, for example, which is also an illegal drug, but we use it often in topical anesthesia or anesthesia for surgeries, is a Schedule 2. So in context, medicinal cannabis Schedule 1 has no therapeutic benefit currently, and cocaine has a Schedule 2, and they're both illegal substances. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, we do recognize, having said that, that we do have an indication for glaucoma, we have an indication for pain. So therefore, it has two indications that we commonly accept and are recognized, and we just need to now appropriately schedule the drug so people can actually use it as a therapeutic agent.
Yeah. I know, because a lot of the NFL players that were complaining about the Super Bowl ad, they were saying that they use it for pain, depending on, you know, which state they're
exactly
in, sort of thing.
So, as I said, it's evolving, and more states now are taking up this marijuana or retracting the marijuana ban and making it legal not only for medicinal but also for recreational purposes. Mm-hmm. We also have the new Chief Medical Officer for the United States, the Surgeon General, that has in his platform to reschedule the drug to a Schedule 2 or beyond, so it can be used for therapeutic purposes as well as to be researched.
Right. So I guess when I was looking up, they see some potential for cancer as well?
Oh, most definitely.
And nausea?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I say most definitely, but we don't have the human trials and actually to test it out. But what they have done, they've taken cancer cells, they've put them in a petri dish, and they've actually then injected in and around the cancer cells cannabis, mm-hmm. both THC and CBD. And what they found is that the cells stopped migrating, they stopped proliferating, and they actually started to die, which we call auto-programmed cell death. And researchers are now seeing that on these cancer cells, they have both CB1 and CB2 receptors, and they do remarkable things in regards to cancers. Now, what we are trying to figure out, though, is dose and how much and how little. Because even in our symposium this weekend at the Orlando Dermatology Conference, the researcher from George Washington University, who did the presentation, he showed that for melanomas, in his experiment, too little didn't do enough, and a little bit more actually had a therapeutic aim. So that's the aim of research now.
Right. So I was looking up, and I was surprised to see like 47 U.S. states have made it legal to use CBD.
Yes.
It was like Nebraska, Idaho, mm-hmm. and I forget what the third state was. Might have been South Dakota or something like mm-hmm. that. But what is CBD and how is it used in various forms?
Great. So cannabis has hundreds of active chemicals. There's only two that we really talk about, and that's CBD and THC. So THC is the one that everyone doesn't quite like but want, because it gives you that euphoria, that high. Mm-hmm. All right, and so the patients love it because it gives them that sort of euphoria, that high. The policymakers don't like it because it gives people that altered state of consciousness. CBD, on the other hand, is more so for anxiety. It helps to relax, helps to calm. It could also be used for seizures as well. But when we're talking about medicinal cannabis, this is where we have to separate the two, mm-hmm. right? Because when we're talking about recreation, people want to go for that high THC content. And when we're talking about medicinal marijuana or cannabis, we're looking for sometimes a one-to-one ratio, or we're looking for something with a high CBD content and a very small or lesser percentage of a THC. So in a nutshell or in summary, patients won't be getting that high or that euphoria that they would get from the cannabis that I would prescribe for patients for medical purposes. And it's also good to mention at this point that patients won't be smoking it either. In reference to medical cannabis, the most advantageous way of getting high therapeutic benefit would be from orals, tinctures, edibles, etc., or even vaporizing in a small case of patients. So those patients who are having seizures, if I feel a seizure coming on, then I would tell the patient to vaporize because it has an immediate onset of action versus taking a pill that's going to probably work within 45 minutes. So that's one of the myths that we want to debunk, is that patients for medicinal cannabis won't necessarily be running around Bermuda smoking. They won't necessarily be getting a high or having an altered state of consciousness, because that's not what our therapeutic aim is trying to achieve.
Right. I guess some of the concerns from those who are against this would be, you know, they're worried about, you know, people having the THC and then getting hooked, and then going on, you know, as a gateway drug to worse.
Very things. Good, and I like when people talk about that, you know, because that's one of the, because in my preparation for a lot of these talks that I do, I was doing some research, and in and around the 1940s, 50s, there was lots of ads that were talking about marijuana as being this gateway drug, makes you hypersexual, hyperviolent, and all these sorts of things to really give it a very bad stigma. And unfortunately, that is perpetuated through society even up to now. So let's debunk the myth. First of all, medical cannabis period, whether it be recreational or medicinal, is safer than eating, what, 8 potatoes. It's safer than having acetaminophen or aspirin. You can overdose and die from aspirin. You will never overdose or die from cannabis. And the reason why we know that as a scientist is because the receptors that deal with respiratory suppression, they don't, in that particular part of the brain, doesn't have the receptors that that react to cannabis whatsoever. Cocaine, as you know, alcohol, as you know, these things, even tobacco smoking, come on. Let's make it very simple. Tobacco smoking causes lung cancer. We know this. Patients who smoke cannabis won't get lung cancer. Mm-hmm. It's not one of those things that they normally get. And actually, there was a great study by a guy at UCLA, and he was studying both cigarette smoking, tobacco, and cannabis, and showed that there was a depreciable lung volume decrease in patients that were smoking cigarettes, and there was no depreciable lung volume or changes in the structure of the lung as a result of smoking cannabis. Now, because cannabis has been around since the year 2736 BC, we kind of know through the evolution of man and science that it doesn't have a lot of adverse effects that some of these other drugs that are available, such as aspirin, tobacco, etc., have. Now, with that said, I must make sure that the public knows that it doesn't mean that it's completely safe and it's not going to do no harm to you.
So what side effects does it have?
Exactly. So, I mean, that altered state of consciousness, you know, most people when they smoke, they become more relaxed. So it's not great for those patients who are younger than 25, who are trying to engage in an academic career, because they lose IQ points. They're going to be more sedated, and that's not something you want as you're going to take an exam.
Right. I know, like, part of the debate when Canada was talking about making it legal was at what age could people buy it, and there was the whole argument about they should wait till they're 25 just because of the brain still developing.
Exactly, and you don't want to affect the delicate chemistry of the brain as it's maturing. But beyond that, it's extremely safe.
You mentioned cigarette smoking, and it was interesting. One of the things I was reading, that they're actually using marijuana to help wean people off of cigarettes as a possible.
Well, I mean, I think the reason being, and that I can put together, I haven't quite seen that ratios or data, is because patients like to do this sort of movement, right? And so if they're smoking something that's pure marijuana, for example, at least they're not going to get the harmful effects of tobacco and all those other additives.
One of the other possible side effects, increased heart rate?
Yeah, increased heart rate and those types of things. But that's patients who are having a very high THC content. They're going to get the euphoric heart rate, the blood pressure changes and whatnot. But still, in comparison to aspirin, cigarette smoking and some of the other things, as in 8 potatoes, it's still a lot safer.
So where do you see Bermuda in its step towards making this legal for patients to be able to have?
Well, I based on what I'm hearing and my meetings with the government officials, it is something that's on their agenda. And I think the Premier David Byrd has made a mandate that it should be passed, a bill should be passed to allow domestic cultivation within the first quarter of this year. So we have our fingers crossed and our toes crossed, and hopefully that he's going to be true to his word and make that actually happen. Because we have a lot of patients that are suffering. And even when it happens, it's still going to be at least a year out before anyone starts to grow anything of high value that our patients could use. So we're still pressing for the government to update its self-imposed limit with the United Nations and just say, hi, United Nations, we want to be able to increase our limit from 1 gram of cannabis a year to something, as I think I wrote to the government, about 27,000 grams per year, so we can actually treat the patients that actually need it now.
How did Canada deal with it?
Canada was, they wrote to the UN and say, we want to increase our limit. And it's your right as a country to inform them of whatever programs that you want to institute. We actually were looking to import from Canada, and they were willing to export it until they realized this UN treaty and was like, hold on, you asked for 10 grams, we can only send you one, until your country writes into the UN and just tells them that they want to increase their limit.
So the process then, government would pass the laws allowing the growth and cultivation, mm-hmm. and then how does it then transform into what is useful for patients?
Right. Well, once it's grown, and there's a lot of people that are contacting me about growing and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about medicinal cannabis, this unfortunately can't be grown really outside. Mm-hmm. It has to be grown in a clean facility, because it can't have any sort of impurities or additives. Can't have any molds or dust mites or etc. Because mm-hmm. these things are going to be used for medicinal purposes. For those for recreational purposes who are smoking, I guess they can do whatever they want and grow wherever. But for when it comes to medical cannabis, it has to be in a controlled environment. So once it's then made, or grown, and harvested and dried and then turned into, compounded into oils, tablets, capsules, creams, it's going to take a little while for that to undergo.
Right. I guess part of the thing is you have the regulations in place, and then once it's the process is started, then you still have oversight, and mm-hmm. Some people might be concerned about, well, they say they're growing it for medical purposes, mm-hmm. but they're using it for recreational.
Yeah, so all those things the government's going to have to really sort out. But I'm like, before we even actually go to that hurdle, let's actually test the waters. Let's actually, first of all, increase our self-imposed limit on cannabis, mm-hmm. So we can actually start to import what we need for the treatment of our patients.
Right. So in your practice here, how many people would you say could benefit from it? And then if you want to extrapolate that out to the...
Well, we actually did some research, because we presented the government with a plan so they can actually validate their numbers. And I use a lot of published research throughout the United States in small towns and also larger towns that showed that... a population may possibly have between 2-6% of its patients, its population requiring... requiring cannabis, right? Yeah. And there's one up to, I think, 10 or 12%. So a population of 65,000 patients, you can do the math. Mm-hmm. I said as initial onset, let's try to get enough for about 2,500 patients.
2,500, that's a considerable number.
It is, because when you got a lot of patients that are on opioids, because they have chronic pain, they're going on methadone at the methadone clinic, not because they're former drug addicts, because that's also another method of pain relief. Then you got patients with cancers, for example. Mm-hmm. We have a huge surge of that in Bermuda. You got patients with seizures. You got patients with pain. Mm-hmm. There's a number of patients that will qualify. Patients with autoimmune conditions, fibromyalgia, lupus, and the list goes on and on. Those patients would also find some benefit from medical cannabis.
I was reading that it's also, they're testing it for Alzheimer's.
Oh, yes.
And we seem to be having a growing population with Alzheimer's.
Oh, most definitely. So in animal models, because mm-hmm. Alzheimer's is started by amyloid plaques in the brain, right? And what they found through animal models and in vitro research, the test tube research, is that the amyloid plaques start to regress as a result of it being bathed in and around cannabis. So there's lots of research, and this has been going on for quite some time. The country that's actually leading the charge is really Israel, mm-hmm. and they have lots of scientific evidence and papers that support that it's really, one, has a therapeutic benefit that needs to be further explored, one, and two, that it doesn't have as much adverse effects as some of the conventional medicines that these patients are on, like opioids and methadone and all these other things. But if there was an overdose, as you know, there's a big opioid crisis in the United States, where police officers now are carrying around the antidote to opioids, because it's such a problem, right? You wouldn't have that with cannabis. And if patients were seeking opioids for pain and out of desperation, then they're actually finding that the opioids are going down by over 20-30% in some of these states, because cannabis is now available.
Now, I know you're sort of leading the charge here in Bermuda, but mm-hmm. what is the rest of the medical community in Bermuda, what your colleagues... Are they backing you, or are they behind you, or are they a little more cautious?
Surprisingly, there's a great deal of support. Mm-hmm. They're not public about it, because I think of I don't know as to why. But no, they are generally support. What I do find is that the younger doctors are more apt to evolve in this particular science. I get referrals from other doctors, you know, sending patients over here for the option, of which I had to tell them that it's no longer an option. We don't have the availability to import, so hold off on the referrals. But yes, there are doctors that are willing to explore it for their patients.
Right. So in the meantime, while somebody is suffering for something and they feel like they could use some sort of cannabis medicinal purposes, is there a facility or a state that you're recommending that they go to in the meantime?
I just tell them find wherever there is closest and easiest for them to travel, whether it be Canada. I don't probably steer them to watch Canada because it's not as open. You have to go actually get a license from a physician and then go and get a permit. So patients like California, Vegas, I was in Vegas for another conference, a rheumatology conference, and they also had a symposium on medical cannabis as it relates to autoimmune conditions, which it was quite interesting to know that even such professional bodies are now evolving into the space that, you know, they're seeing that cannabis could be a possible option. So, but in Vegas, you can just walk right into a dispensary and get whatever you like.
From your point of view, what would be the biggest caution as we move forward? I'm still moving forward, but like, you know, as a warning or a caution or things that we need to be concerned about.
I don't think Bermuda needs to be as open as Vegas and some of the other states in reference to you can just walk into a dispensary over the age of 18 or whatever age in that particular state and just get whatever you want. Because, you know, it does have, as I mentioned, for patients under the age of 25, have some adverse effects in reference to brain and cognition and mental function, right? So you want to be able to protect those individuals from doing things that may detriment their academic or professional careers, even though alcohol is available. So we do have to, you know, make sure that we have an even playing field, especially something as inert as cannabis versus alcohol. There really isn't much of a comparison in regards to adverse effects. People, when they smoke, they go lay down. They don't generally operate a motor vehicle and go drive around and cause accidents, right? Like they would do with roadside sobriety and these alcohol measures that are being taken into place now. So, but to answer your question, in Bermuda, I think we should stick with the medical space initially, and then as a society make a determination if we want to be able to open it up further.
Yeah. It's interesting you talk about alcohol, because one of the social media things from the Super Bowl, I keep referencing, but like the Eagles defensive end tweeted, keep promoting the booze ads, guys. You're doing
exactly
great.
Budweiser and everybody else is all over the Super Bowl, and you know I don't really know why their reason, but one of the reasons that I can probably think about the reason why they did not approve the ads, because Super Bowl is going to be really available in every state, every country, on TV, right? And some of these countries, they have a prohibition or a law against cannabis, when generally most of these countries, every country has no law against alcohol, other than for minors.
Dealing with minors, because one of the things you talked about was edibles. And, you know, again, trying to protect our young people, because there have been incidences in other places where, you know, brownies or cookies or whatever, you know, have been accidentally digested by children, because they see a brownie or they see a cookie, their natural instinct.
Let's go have one.
Yeah,
and they have too much, and then they end up with a terrible headache, and probably some nausea and vomiting and feeling unwell, and that's because they just did too much. And that's the difference, you know. And that's recreational cannabis. You wouldn't get that sort of issue pretty much from medicinal cannabis, because it's variants of THC, which gives you those side effects, is not so high.
Now, we've mentioned the Super Bowl quite a bit, so just want to finish off today. Well, before we finish off, is there anything else that you want to say that maybe I haven't asked you?
Well, I think from an educational point of view, I think people have to understand that, first of all, it's been around for the ancients of times. It's been used in Ayurvedic medicine. It's been used throughout China. It's on the hieroglyphs of Egypt. So, first of all, it's been around for a while. And second of all, as a result of evolution, and because it's been around and been widely used, even Queen Victoria used it for her menstrual cramps. That was her drug of choice for menstrual cramps. Our bodies have adapted a system called the endocannabinoid system that's actually well-suited for cannabis. And many scientists now are saying that because, as a result of a dysregulation in that endocannabinoid system, we get disease like fibromyalgia and a whole many others, even migraines. There's a study shown now that I just read about migraines. They actually did spinal taps on these patients and realized that one of these endocannabinoid agents called adapamide is very low in those patients with migraines. And then when they gave patients anandamide, and or cannabis, the levels went up and their migraines abated. So science is evolving. There was another great study that I would like to mention about Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis in the European Journal of Gastroenterology. I mean, these are big name journals and societies that are now doing research. And they had a study that showed that 65% of patients, when they took CBD oil, cannabis oil or extracts orally, they had a clearance in their disease. That's 65%. So six out of 10 patients would have remission from their Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, or an improvement in their symptomatology by taking this particular medicinal herb.
Right. 65% is a high number.
It sure is. And that's why it raised eyebrows and it's making moves or ripple effects throughout the medical community, because if there now has a double-blinded, randomized controlled placebo trial, that means that they gave people technically another oil, which has no therapeutic benefit, and they gave patients cannabis. The researcher who gave them the medication didn't know which one was getting what, but the evaluators knew. And that's what they mean by double-blinded, randomized, controlled. So no one knows what they're getting, and they're just testing the outcomes. And so that's the creme de la creme of science. And it showed such a high rate of improvement.
Now, I don't know if you're an American football fan, but with the Super Bowl coming up, who do you like, the New England Patriots or the Los Angeles Rams?
I like to normally go for the underdogs. So whoever the underdogs are, that's who I'm going to be rooting for.
Well, unbelievably or not, I think Vegas has the Patriots as a one-point underdog right now.
Well, there we go. That's who I'll probably root for. Okay. And hopefully they win this year.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Brown.
Thank you.
It was great having you here, and maybe getting a little bit more information out for the general public. I guess on an issue like this, is an information campaign. Mm-hmm. It's probably going to have to be ongoing.
Most definitely.
Because a lot of fears and, people's prejudice or what they've been taught over decades, it takes a little while to break down.
Most definitely.
So we had Dr. Brown here talking about medicinal cannabis, medicinal marijuana. I'm Don Burgess. Thank you for tuning in to Facebook Live for Burr News, and hope you have a Bermudaful day.